Thank you very much for the invitation and to Johnny Steinberg for arranging this. It's great to be here, and after spending the last 3 weeks since the book has been published, traveling all over the place. I was in the US, where I was in 9 cities in 12 days, and sort of lost track of where I was, what day of the week it was, and what I was talking about. It's really nice to be able to focus on one aspect of what is a fairly substantial book, and this is the version post the first draft, which was cut by about 35%. And when I first submitted it to the lawyers who were legaling it for my publishers, Penguin, before I'd even got back to my office, which was about half an hour away from his office, he'd phoned me and said, "Have I misunderstood, or are there almost 3,000 footnotes?" And I said, "I'm afraid there are." And he said, "I think I might have to cancel my holiday plans." So it's wonderful to be able to focus on one section of the book, which concentrates on Africa, which has perhaps seen the most devastating consequences of the trade in weapons, the arms trade. I'm going to try and put that in some sort of a global context, though, and related to the themes of the book as a whole. And obviously, in the time we have for discussion afterwards, please feel free to pursue any of the avenues that I might touch on, even some of those that I might omit to touch on, because the book is very wide-ranging. And the reason for that is that, coming out of the South African experience that William mentioned, when I moved to the UK after leaving Parliament, I was besieged by people working on the weapons trade, ranging from investigators, prosecutors, investigative journalists, whistleblowers from within defense companies. And it occurred to me, as I started working with them, that there hasn't really been an holistic account of the global arms trade in an accessible form, probably since Anthony Sampson's The Arms Bazaar, the first edition of which was published in early 1979. And while it went on to be published in many editions, that was really the bedrock of the information that had been given. So I felt that, having focused so much in my first book and in my brief political career on those who had been corrupted, that it was important to match that with those who were doing the corrupting. And that is effectively what this book is trying to do. So to provide an accessible narrative account of all sides of the arms trade. To give you some sort of perspective of the trade, global military expenditure in 2010 is estimated to have totaled $1.6 trillion. That's $235 for every person on the planet. Today, the US spends almost $1 trillion a year on national security, with a defense budget of just over $703 billion. And I suppose it is one of the many ironies of this trade that President Obama's first two defense budgets were, in fact, the largest since the Second World War, continuing the trend that had obviously, had really been started under Ronald Reagan, but intensified under the administration of George W. Bush. The trade in conventional arms, which is what I focus on, and this is both big and small, so everything from small and light weapons, which have such impact, particularly in Africa, but all the way through to the high-tech, very sophisticated stuff, jet fighters, aircraft carriers, and of course, more recently, drones, which is the direction in which a lot of warfare is going. And the trade in conventional arms is worth, on average, about $60 billion a year. It obviously varies from year to year. For instance, for this current year, the expectation is that it will be significantly higher than that, because the United States is in the process of finalizing a $60 billion weapons deal with Saudi Arabia. who are amongst the biggest purchasers on a consistent basis around the world. And the sorts of deals that this amount involves, and I should point out that this is an amount referring to the formal trade, because the trade in arms stretches across a continuum of different institutional variants and a variety of legality and ethics, from the official or formal trade, what is sometimes called the government-to-government trade, all the way to the black market, and that is arms deals that are entirely illegal in conception and execution. And between them sit what is referred to as the grey market, which has elements of illegality and legality, and are often used as a tool of foreign policy by governments, probably more often than not in covert ways. Now, in practice, the boundaries between these three markets are quite fuzzy. They're often intertwined and dependent on each other. But the one thing that seems common to them all is that bribery and corruption is de rigueur. Over the more than 11 years that I've been working on the arms trade and meeting with people all over the world who work on it, I have yet to find a single arms deal that does not involve some element of illegality. And most of this illegality takes place through middlemen, sometimes called arms agents, arms dealers, arms brokers, and each of these definitions have slightly different meanings and practices. And I think what is crucial about the role of these middlemen is that many arms dealers who provide services to the large defense companies and to governments continue, while they're doing so, to operate in the black and gray markets. In a quite remarkable piece of work that accessed extremely hard to obtain information both from national treasuries around the world and from some of the major intelligence agencies in the world, a guy called Joe Rober, who at the time was with Transparency International, calculated that the trade in weapons accounts for around 40% of all corruption in all world trade. So the obvious question arises, which is, why is this particular trade so susceptible to corruption? And Joe argued, and I agree with him, that the trade is hardwired for corruption. The very structure of the way in which weapons deals are constructed explains the prevalence and the nature of the corruption that we find in it. And these elements would include things like the imposed secrecy on everything that happens, related both to national security and commercial confidentiality. And I don't argue that there is no need for secrecy in these deals. Instead, I argue that what has happened is that the needs of national security and commercial confidentiality are used to hide what is basically criminal behavior, so that it is extended to aspects of arms deals that in fact have no impact on national security, but certainly makes it easier for the payments of bribes and other forms of corruption. Also, what I describe as the intimacy of buyers, suppliers, and their brokers, including between governments and their arms companies, where a lot of the defense companies, even if they are publicly listed entities, are treated as and operate as quasi-state entities. So, for instance, senior executives of Britain's biggest defense manufacturers have easy access to the Ministry of Defense, to the military forces in the United Kingdom. And then, of course, there's the added dimension of relationships between intelligence agencies and the defense companies, as well as links between the intelligence agencies and a lot of the middlemen. And this, I would argue, is why some of these middlemen, in fact the vast majority of them, are not prosecuted, are not brought to account for all the sorts of activities they're involved in, because an enormous number of them have been used historically or are currently being used as intelligence assets, either by their own government's intelligence agencies or by the intelligence agencies of governments to whom they're able to be useful. There are also significant institutional links that I'll draw out through examples between the large defense contractors and these middlemen who operate in the black or gray markets, what I refer to as a whole as the shadow world. Now, the other factor that contributes to this corrupt DNA in the trade is the sophistication, the fragmentation, and the opacity of global production, transportation, and financial networks and instruments that are used in concluding arms deals. Obviously, the product is of a highly technical nature most of the time. Obviously, that applies less to small and light weapons. There are also a myriad procurement pressures that are brought to bear on arms deals that don't apply to a lot of other procurement, and again, I'll talk a little bit about that. And then, of course, the high financial rewards together with a lack of consequences for wrongdoing. I argue in the book and give myriad examples of how this entire trade seems to operate in something of a parallel legal universe. So, in practical terms, in very simplistic terms, even in the formal trade, where you only have four or five major deals a year, each of those deals is worth tens of millions of dollars. So it's absolutely crucial to the financial well-being of the defense contractors who are bidding for those contracts. In addition to which, in the buying countries, you have a very small number of individuals who actually take the final decisions on these massive contracts. And we've been able to estimate that on the vast majority of government-to-government deals, there are on average six people who are responsible for the final decision. Now, when you have something that is worth so much money, with so few people involved in the decision-making, it makes the payment of vast bribes quite easy. And then, when all of this takes place behind the veil of secrecy that I mentioned, it creates what is fertile ground for corruption. And the corruption takes many forms, sometimes blatant bribery, simply the payment of monies to key decision makers or people close to them. Undeclared conflicts of interest is extremely common in this industry. The promise of post-employment, especially where the revolving door between the state and defense companies and government is common, the United States being by far the most extreme example of that in the world. During 2010, 84% of generals retiring from the Pentagon went into senior executive positions with large defense contractors to whom they had awarded contracts during their careers. So that would obviously be the most extreme example. And then the offer of preferential business access, which occurs regularly with the use of economic offsets in large arms deals. Now, economic and industrial offsets, which I'll talk a bit about in the South African example, are, in my estimation, so much economic sophistry. And they provide two main purposes in arms contracts. The first is they are a way for politicians to justify what otherwise seems to be inexplicable spending on high-tech weaponry. And second of all, they are a very good conduit for the payment of bribes. Now, the consequences of these types of corruption, and as importantly, the efforts to conceal the corruption, include, amongst other things, the corrosion of democratic institutions and the rule of law in both buying and, importantly, selling countries, greater instability in fragile states, massive opportunity costs, especially in relation to socioeconomic development, and sometimes, ironically, an undermining of the very national security that the deals are intended to bolster. There is little doubt, which is why, besides my own origins, Africa has an extensive section in the book devoted to it, that the continent has borne the brunt of the impact of the trade in arms. As the easy availability of weapons has fueled and perpetuated conflict, and I would argue increased the intensity and brutality of a number of those conflicts across the continent. Of crucial importance is the historical reality that the continent has an inheritance from its time as a Cold War stage of massive amounts of surplus military materiel and weaponry. This has been exacerbated by the approach of particularly the United States to the continent in recent years, the creation of AFRICOM, which ultimately means that American attitudes to Africa are now formed and enacted through a military prism. China's massive and increasing influence is also buttressed through the selling and sometimes gifting of weaponry to states, to informal formations, and in the case of those states, regardless of their international status. So what I'm going to do is give you some indicative examples of the impact of the trade in Africa through an example of the formal government-to-government deal, which I try to investigate as a member of parliament, through an example of perhaps one of the most venal illicit deals that was conducted in Africa, and also the story of one of the many illicit dealers who straddles both the formal and the black world. So as William mentioned, I had the enormous privilege of serving as an ANC Member of Parliament, first in the provincial legislature from 1994, and then in the national government from the beginning of 1997. And towards the end of 1998, the beginning of 1999, the government decided to enter into a series of contracts for military materiel and weaponry that is known collectively as the arms deal. Ultimately, when these contracts reach their conclusion in 2018, the deal, together with its financing, will have cost South Africa around $10 billion. $300 million in bribes were paid on this deal. Now, in the early years of the country's democracy, we had put in place what I regard with great bias as a quite remarkable public financial management framework. And I say with bias because I chaired the committee that drafted the legislation that created this framework, something called the Public Finance Management Act. In one deal, the trade in arms rent this framework asunder. In perhaps the most odious and certainly the most expensive contract, the then defense minister at the time, Joe Modise, completely undermined the procurement process to ensure that a bid by BAE and Saab, a joint bid, won a contract for the supply of a jet trainer and fighter to South Africa. The genesis of this was that 9 countries bid for this largest contract. On the first shortlist, the BAE Saab offer did not even make the technical shortlist, and that was primarily for 2 reasons. They proposed a separate trainer and fighter jet, which didn't meet some of the technical specifications required by the South African Air Force and overspecified in certain other areas, and the cost of their proposal was 2.5 times more expensive than the combination trainer fighter jet that the South African Air Force actually wanted. So to deal with this situation, Modise did a number of things that President Thabo Mbeki would later describe as visionary. The first was to change the technical specifications so that despite the cost factors and despite the wishes of the Air Force, he decided that a separate trainer and fighter jet would be required. So there would be 2 contracts. Then, when BAE Saab still didn't make the shortlist, he insisted that the technical committee set up by the Air Force draw up a new shortlist on which BAE Saab had to appear. So they dropped the 3rd placed bid and they put in BAE Saab as 3rd on the shortlist of 3. In order to change that, on the single largest contract that the Democratic South Africa has ever signed, Minister Modise, 2/3 of the way through this procurement process, decided in his wisdom to exclude cost as a procurement criteria. This put BAE and Saab in 2nd place. So some more vision was required from the minister. In this instance, he changed the weighting of the economic offsets so that they now accounted for over 50% of the criteria on this particular contract. In addition to which, he gave BAE and Saab the opportunity to resubmit their offset offering, an opportunity that was not given to the other two bids that were on the shortlist. Now, unsurprisingly, at this point, BAE and Saab topped the list. And an informal meeting held in Durban involving less than 30% of the members of the ministerial committee that was supposed to be the final decision-making body, which Thabo Mbeki chaired, had a discussion one night. The next morning, the two Defence Force representatives were approached in their hotel by the head of procurement in the Defence Force, who had been the secretary to the previous evening's meeting, a chap called Chippy Sheikh. And Chippy handed over to the two gentlemen the minutes of the previous night's meeting, in which it was recorded that a formal decision had been taken to accept the BAE and Saab bid. Now, the two gentlemen in question objected, saying that this decision had not been taken unless they had both become extremely hard of hearing, and that it was an informal meeting, not formally constituted, and was not quorate. Sheikh went away and simply signed the minutes himself. And those became the official minutes in terms of which the contract was awarded. Within days of this huge contract being signed, Joe Modisa left government to become chairman of a company that made tens of millions of rands from the offset arrangements with BAE and Saab. His shares in the company, which when he joined the company were worth around 30 million rand, had been bought for him by persons or organizations unknown to this day. And their value in the first 3 months in which he was chairman of the company and in which they were awarded these offset contracts increased just under tenfold. Now, it could be argued, quite legitimately, that the Anglo-Swedish bid won its contract in return for their support of the anti-apartheid struggle, or possibly because Sweden and the United Kingdom are extremely important trading partners to South Africa, which is a small and very open economy. I would suggest that it might also have something to do, and remember, this is a contract that the Air Force said they would only accept these planes from BAE and Saab if forced to do so by the politicians. And they said this publicly. That was their extent of their opposition to this contract. So I would suggest that the award might also have had something to do with Joe Modisa's relationship with Conlog, the company of which he became chairman, and could have also had something to do with the fact that on this one contract, £115 million of bribes were paid to Joe Modisa, to his political advisor Fana Longwane, to Chippy Sheikh, the head of procurement in the Defence Force, to a number of other senior officials and politicians, and sad to say, to my own political party, the ANC itself. So that when I was re-elected in the 1999 elections in South Africa, little did I know that that election campaign was almost entirely funded from the proceeds of the bribes paid by the winning contractors on the arms deal. But the bribes were paid through an extraordinarily labyrinthine maze of offshore financial companies, most of them located in the British Virgin Islands and, interestingly, in the Netherlands, and using a combination of overt and covert agents. The main covert agent, one John Bredenkamp, is on EU and US financial sanctions lists as a crony of and weapons salesman to Robert Mugabe, and has been very active in the Democratic Republic of Congo, including in a company with huge natural resource interests in the DRC, in which Mugabe and his cronies are alleged to have a fairly significant stake. I should mention because he has been writing me threatening letters ever since my first book was published, and because his lawyers have been in contact with me ever since they heard I was writing a second book, that Mr. Bredenkamp denies all of the allegations contained in my book, but remains on the US and the EU financial sanctions list, which he describes as purely an administrative measure. To cover up the corruption in the arms deal, the leaders of the ANC, most of whom had been involved in the overthrow of apartheid and the advent of democracy in South Africa, which makes the South Africa of today, with all of its difficulties and problems and challenges, a fundamentally better place than it ever could have been before 1994. But in order to hide the corruption in this deal, the leaders of the ANC were prepared to undermine some of the very institutions of that democracy that they had played such a huge role in creating. So, when I refused to stop the investigation from Parliament, I was removed from the Public Accounts Committee, on which I was the ranking ANC member, a committee that since 1994 had never voted, always took decisions by consensus, had taken issue with, demanded money back from, and led to the firing of the heads of four departments of government, became just like any other parliamentary committee in that parties voted along party lines, and it became a committee that investigated only what the political leadership of the majority party would allow it to investigate. After being thrown off the committee, I continued to go to meetings of the Public Accounts Committee and existed for 3 months in this charade of I would go to the meeting and ask questions about the arms deal, which were not on the agenda, and would then walk out of the committee room to be met by two whips who would then start yet another set of disciplinary proceedings against me. And eventually, when it became possible for the ANC, which in terms of South Africa's constitutional system it is, to remove people from the parliamentary list and put the next person on the list up, I was informed by the organization's general secretary that I was going to be removed from Parliament. I resigned about 2 nights before that happened. But it wasn't just Parliament, which from this point on became not much more than a rubber stamp for the wishes of the executive, and has remained as such as far as I'm concerned. The prosecutorial and investigative bodies, which are supposed to be constitutionally independent, were called in by President Mbeki and told exactly who and what they could and could not investigate. The criteria was simple. If you were an ally of the president, it didn't matter how much corruption you'd been involved in. So Joe Modise was barely investigated. And the final report of the investigation that did eventually take place, they included one paragraph about his changing of the procurement criteria. But their report went to the presidency before it went to Parliament, and the presidency edited it. And that's where they changed that and replaced it with the line that the minister had displayed a visionary approach to the procurement process. Two anti-corruption agencies, one immediately, another a few years later, were closed down as they were seen as too vigorous in their desire to investigate certain politicians, and as the political currents moved, so those bodies found themselves out of favor. And the highest prosecutorial authorities were later shown to have been complicit in accepting their political instructions. It is my contention that the deal and its cover-up were the point at which South Africa's nascent democracy lost its moral compass. It provided a modus operandi for a string of vast, corrupt deals that have taken place in a variety of sectors since then, that have benefited whatever the small ruling clique at the time was, and that have benefited the ANC itself. At its last triennial congress, the Treasurer General, without submitting a written financial report, announced that the party had profits of just over 1.2 billion rand, which is not bad going for a political party. As you probably know, our current president, Jacob Zuma, whose financial advisor, the brother of Chippy Sheikh, the head of procurement in the Defence Force, was jailed effectively for bribing or for corrupting Zuma in relation to the arms deal, was facing 783 counts of corruption, fraud and racketeering. The charges were controversially dropped 10 days before he was elected president by the acting equivalent of the Attorney General in this country, who was made an acting High Court judge 3 weeks after the elections. A few weeks ago, South Africa's Deputy President, Kgalema Motlanthe, again publicly lamented the fact that the ANC and government at all levels are drowning in a sea of corruption. The money spent on the arms deal, talking of opportunity costs, could have built more than 2 million houses for poor South Africans, created more than 100,000 low-skilled jobs a year for 10 years in a country with an unemployment rate of almost 30%. Even more tragically, according to a study by the School of Public Health at the Kennedy School at Harvard, 355,000 South Africans died avoidable deaths over a five-year period after the arms deal contracts were concluded, because the state claimed it did not have the fiscal resources to provide antiretrovirals for the over 5.5 million people living with HIV and AIDS then. Even after overcoming Thabo Mbeki's shameful denialism, for every 1 rand spent on combating the AIDS pandemic, South Africa thus far has spent over 7.60 rand on the arms deal. Meanwhile, 11 of the 24 trainer jets have ever been in the air, and 12 of the 26 fighter jets purchased have never been used, because South Africa cannot afford the fuel to fly them regularly and cannot afford to train the pilots to fly them. In Sweden, an initial investigation into Saab was dropped after 10 years of denying they had paid bribes. Earlier this year, the company admitted, just a few months ago, under pressure from civil society organizations in Sweden and the prosecutor that myself and my researchers have been working with for just over a year now, that unauthorized commissions, what ordinary people understand as bribes, had been paid to the then defense minister's political advisor, Farnach Longwane. They claimed 24 million Swedish krona, 24 million rand, give or take, had been paid to him. However, for those of us who've seen his bank statements over a number of years, he's received at least 20 million pounds from that particular source. Saab blamed BAE Systems for the payment. And why they did this is because the United Kingdom's Serious Fraud Office had recently settled with BAE Systems, fining them £500,000 for accounting irregularities in relation to a corrupt deal in Tanzania, agreeing to drop investigations into the company in 4 other corrupt deals around the world, including the South African deal, and agreeing, most remarkably, not to allege corruption against the company or in any third-party investigation for a period of 10 years. Interestingly, though, when settling with the US Department of Justice and the US State Department for an amount of around $480 million in fines, which seems big, but was only a small percentage of the profit that BAE Systems alone made on the South African deal, BAE was forced, in the settlement letters in the United States, to admit to paying unauthorized commissions on all 4 of these deals and on a 5th deal with Saudi Arabia. Many of you will know it as the Al Yamamah deal, the biggest arms deal in history and perhaps the most corrupt transaction in all trading history, in which over £6 billion in commissions were paid through this elaborate money laundering system that BAE Systems had set up in the British Virgin Islands. Ironically, when the decision to settle with BAE was announced, I happened to be at the Serious Fraud Office offices, giving yet another formal statement to the investigating team working on South Africa, who knew nothing about the settlement, hadn't been consulted, in contradiction of the regulations governing the SFO, and claimed they had a very strong case in the South African matter. The decision by the SFO caused a leading South African politician who is now mayor of Cape Town to pronounce that the UK had lost the moral authority to talk about good governance and fighting corruption. Patricia de Lille said, and I quote, "They are no better than any of the rogue leaders in Africa who have used funds from bribes and arms deals to stay in power." It is my contention that such decisions are an affront to the British justice system and undermine the reputation of Britain, its businesses and its government. At the same time, the British taxpayers continue to subsidize the country's arms industry in times of economic difficulty. But sadly, this sort of outcome is only too common in the arms business. In Germany, one of the two companies that paid bribes on the South African deal, in this instance amounting to just over $25 million, to, amongst others, Chippy Sheikh, the head of procurement, they unfortunately claimed these commission payments in tax rebates a year after it had become illegal to do so in Germany. They were investigated and then quietly paid a fine to tax authorities in Germany. Despite overwhelming evidence of the bribes that they had paid, nothing was made public in Germany about the bribes that had led to the infraction, which in and of themselves broke German law as well as South African law. And this is the supposedly formal or cleaner trade in arms. The illicit trade is even more venal. I'm going to cite just one historical example, and even though it is a fairly old example, the reason I'm using it, there are many, many other examples in the book, is because it so exemplifies the very direct links between the trade and the use to which the weapons are being put. Now, I'm not in any way trying to argue that the arms trade somehow causes the conflicts in Africa or anywhere else. What I am suggesting is that it impacts on the intensity and brutality of these conflicts and often perpetuates them longer than might be necessary. Leonid Minin is a Ukrainian-Israeli Israeli arms dealer currently residing in Rome. The reason I raise the fact that he's not only Ukrainian but also Israeli is because over the years that I've investigated the trade, one thing that I just could not understand was why Israel and Israelis seem to pop up in most of the arms deals taking place in the illicit trade. And about 2.5 years ago, while I was in Israel interviewing various people involved in the industry, I got at least a partial answer. Until 4 years ago, on retiring from the IDF as an officer, which is compulsory to do at the age of 45, it was almost as easy as putting one's signature onto a pro forma document to get a license to trade in weapons. So for somebody who has spent all of his adult life in the military, facing the prospect of the rest of his life, and it usually is a he, although there is one very famous female Israeli arms dealer who acts as a supplier to President Obiang of Equatorial Guinea, facing the rest of one's life, not quite knowing what one is going to do, the prospect of being able to engage in arms deals, one or two of which can be lucrative enough to set you up for the rest of your life, is extremely tempting. So, Leonid Minin who moved from the Ukraine to Israel after he had run into particular trouble with the Odessa Mafia, of which he was at one point a part, became very involved with the regime of President Charles Taylor in Liberia and Taylor's involvement with the RUF movement in the Sierra Leonean Civil War. And there is an extraordinary example of young RUF soldiers, some of them with incisions in the side of their head into which had been pushed crack cocaine, amphetamines in some instances, and then bandaged round. These young soldiers had been waiting on the outskirts of Freetown, the capital. They were involved in a mission called Operation No Living Thing, part of the objective of which was to free their jailed leader, who they believed was held in Freetown, part of which was simply to sow terror and mayhem amongst the inhabitants of the capital. However, they were short of weaponry. Leonard Minnan had been tasked by Charles Taylor with providing them with weapons. So he took his private jet, which was still painted in the colors of the Seattle Sonics basketball team from whom he had bought it, and flew two shipments, ultimately from the Ukraine, but really from Chad, into Monrovia. It's an extraordinary photo of the weapons. They had been seat-belted into the chairs of this jet because he hadn't yet had time to convert it into a freight plane. So literally, one of the investigators who uncovered this shipment managed to get onto the plane and take a photograph of these rows of seats whose passengers, safely seat-belted, were deadly weapons. The first shipment arrived on the 22nd of December 1998, the second a few days later. They were taken off the plane by Taylor's men, put into jeeps and trucks, taken across the border to the outskirts of Freetown. On the 6th of January 1999, Operation No Living Thing began. In less than 2 weeks, 100,000 people were forced from their homes, most of which were torched to the ground. Thousands, if not tens of thousands, of young women were raped. There were stories of women rubbing mud onto their faces to try and look darker and, in their perception, less attractive to the attackers to avoid sexual assault. Tens of thousands of people were left maimed and injured. 6,000 civilians were murdered. The leaders of the RUF had heard that what was happening after their signature act, which was to cut off the hands of their victims, international aid groups were sewing some of these hands back on. So these young soldiers, high on amphetamines, were issued with Hessian sacks and ordered to bring back the hands they were chopping off. Those were the two most profitable weapons runs in Leonard Minnan's long and extremely profitable career. He was eventually arrested in a sleazy hotel room just outside Milan about 2.5 years after this run. He was found, in the words of the chief of police who arrested him, lying passed out on a bed like a naked, very pale whale, was, I think, the words of the chief of police. There was cocaine lying all around him on the floor, on the bed, on the desk. There were some rough diamonds. There were 4 prostitutes from 4 different countries. There was a pornographic film flickering on the back wall. I mean, it really sounds as though this was a set arranged by a rather poor director of a very poor B-grade movie. But this is what actually happened. And extraordinarily, amongst all of this, were also thousands and thousands of documents about Minion's various illegal arms deals. So they put him away for 2.5 years for drug offenses. They then kept him under arrest while they continued to investigate the arms deals. And it was an extraordinary operation. They investigated, I would estimate, about 40% of the world's illegal arms dealers at that time, around the world. They had an extraordinary case against him. 2 days before the case came to court in Italy, Italy's biggest defense manufacturer, a company called Finmeccanica, the BAE Systems of Italy, if you will, sent more than a dozen of its top lawyers to work with Leonard Minin's legal team, which consisted of one lawyer. He had fired four in the previous 4 months. Before the first day of the trial got underway, this new legal team appealed to a higher court in Rome and received an order from that court that Italy had no jurisdiction to try Minin for these offences. Despite the fact that he was married to an Italian woman, had been a permanent resident in Italy for at least 14 years before this date, that a number of the deals that he was to be tried for were negotiated on Italian soil, that a significant amount of the money that he had made from these deals were paid into Italian bank accounts. They had no jurisdiction. Governments and big defense contractors are often involved with illicit dealers of this sort. John Bredenkamp, BAE Systems, a chap called Joe de Hovsepian, a Beirut-based Lebanese-Armenian who I had found in a commission of inquiry on a South African deal that happened during the political transition in South Africa and tracked for years and years. And eventually, on the advice of my then 14-year-old niece in Cape Town, looked for him on Facebook, which is where I found him. So I wrote to him and got a one-line reply. No hello, just, in my long life, I have never done anything for nothing. Why should I start now? And one of my researchers, Paul Holden, who has himself written two superb books on the South African arms deal, the latest which has been published just a few weeks ago, called The Devil in the Detail, Paul said to me, no, the one thing we do have is flattery. So I proceeded to write letters to this guy. Every time I met anyone to do with the arms trade, I'd write to him and say, so-and-so says that you know more about the global arms trade than anyone else alive, and I simply can't write this book without speaking to you. He'd never been interviewed before. And then, bizarrely, out of the blue, sitting in my office in North London, I get a call from him. And this very Germanic voice says, I'll be in my office in Amman, Jordan on Sunday. He has 8 or 9 offices around the world. Why don't you come and have a chat? And I jumped on the first plane I could, and off I went to Jordan. And I spent 2/3 of a day listening to de Hovsepian, who wears a huge Stetson wherever he is. So the picture is in the book. He's wearing his Stetson when he drove me back to my hotel, because like every arms dealer I've met, he's absolutely charming, larger than life. And he was shocked to hear I was taking a taxi back to my hotel. So he drove me back with his Stetson on. And he spent that day regaling me with how he'd started in the industry with a company formed by a former senior Nazi officer, a guy called Gerhard Mertens, in Germany, just after the Second World War. And in the 50s, their main deals were facilitated for them by German intelligence and the CIA. They used Klaus Barbie as an agent for 2.5 years to do business with Pinochet's regime in Chile, amongst others. They would sell to anyone. King Farouk, and when he was overthrown by Nasser, they carried on selling to Nasser. There was no ideology, even though they were all neo-Nazis. It was whoever could pay, which remains the template of most arms dealers. And then Joe was unsurprisingly double-crossed by Gerhard Mertens, who, when he told Mertens' sons about this, and his sons are still in the arms business, based just outside of Washington, D.C., and according to de Hovsepian, doing a lot of work through the CIA. When de Hovsepian told the sons, who he's still fairly close to, that their father had defrauded him of around $1 million, they said, well, that puts you at about 17th on the list. So this was common practice in the way that Mertens operated. So de Hovsepian did his own thing and went his own way and was involved in a range of illicit deals, favoring deals that broke UN arms embargoes, because you could charge a premium if there was an arms embargo on a country, because it was more difficult to get the stuff in. We managed to estimate during the course of the research for the book that there have been around 502 violations of UN arms embargoes since they were instituted. One has resulted in a court case, and the person involved was acquitted. So de Hovsepian told me this tale of his involvement in some of the worst arms deals of the last 40 years. He's now very active in Yemen. As far as I can gather, selling to pretty much anyone who wants weapons in Yemen, which is pretty much everyone. And then he pulled out his contractor ID for his work for the U.S. Department of Defense in Iraq and Afghanistan, and his work for USAID in Iraq and Afghanistan and Liberia. He said, to be a player in the global arms trade today, legal, illegal, you've got to be in bed with the country that buys and sells and manufactures almost as much as the rest of the world combined, which is the United States. He also happens to think that the United States is the biggest terrorist threat to the world. But he puts aside those concerns to do business with them. The arms trade in Africa and beyond is replete with examples of blowback, the unintended consequences of the trade, often a consequence of linkages between the formal and illicit worlds. And the recent Arab Spring has, of course, resulted in a whole lot of examples. There's the case of Libya, where the irony of the initial NATO airstrikes is that they had to destroy some fairly sophisticated weapons that had been sold to Gaddafi by most of NATO's member countries. From 2003, when Gaddafi was rehabilitated in the eyes of the West and the US, those countries sold him a huge amount of weaponry. When David Cameron spoke of how proud he was in Britain's role in the demise of Gaddafi, it obviously just slipped his mind that Britain had provided the dictator with £120 million in advanced weaponry from 2005 to the time at which he was overthrown. That his first foray into the region, while the Arab Spring was at its height, was with a coterie of senior executives from Britain's defense industry. And because NATO countries and Russia had sold Gaddafi more equipment than he could even use, more equipment than he had the personnel to operate, a lot of that weaponry was stockpiled in warehouses that, unsurprisingly, during the transition, were unguarded. The significant amount of that weaponry has already turned up on the world's weapons black markets. So that with about $50,000, you can head off to peripheral areas of Egypt and Libya and buy yourself a surface-to-air missile system that has the capability to take down a commercial jet airliner. And wherever we look in Africa, weapons have played a role. To mention some of the cases covered in the book, in Angola, the Angola Gate scandal, where the French minister most directly involved and selling huge numbers of weapons to the Angolan government, again in defiance of French law and an arms embargo, was recently acquitted on appeal. The seventh time he has been acquitted on charges of grand corruption. The two arms dealers involved had their sentences commuted by half, even though they continue to be involved. One of them has served his time in jail, the other has been on the run from French justice ever since the initial decision. The two of them continue to be involved in a massive money laundering scam linked to the weapons deal that continues to this day, defrauding the national treasuries of two countries. Or Rwanda, and the extraordinary role of the French, and the weapons procurement base that was set up in Paris in the lead up to the genocide, in the DRC, where sadly Rwanda has used its victim status to continue to engage in conflict, and according to UN reports, commit atrocities. The Sudan, where Chinese weapons have become so important. And the open-air arms bazaars of Mogadishu that I also have managed to source photographs of, that reflects the problem of the free availability of weapons in Africa so graphically. But rather than just see this, which it can tend to be, and believe me, having worked on it for over 11 years, I should know that it can be pretty depressing and fair. There is something that can be done about this. This trade doesn't have to operate the way it currently does. National laws, regional and international agreements could be far stronger and meaningfully enforced. The EU common position on arms exports, which is regarded as the best of its kind, it was enacted shortly before the South African deal was negotiated. And it violated at least two articles. But it didn't apply in the South African case because government-to-government contracts are excluded from the common position. And in fact, when I interviewed the head of the Swedish body that regulates arms exports, and I asked him the hypothetical question of whether his body would frown upon issuing an export license for a company that had been shown to be involved in corruption in selling weapons. He said, well, it depends where it sells to. You know, if it's in a rather unsophisticated country, and I think he was referring to South Africa, we don't really take any notice of it, because even if there's been a court case, Their judicial values are often different to our own. And so when I asked him whether, you know, how they felt about the common position of the EU, his response was, well, there's certain of the articles that are extremely difficult to implement, so we simply ignore them. And this is Sweden. There are also obviously problems with policing, investigations, and prosecuting of protagonists in the arms trade because it is such a transnational or multinational activity. And investigative work and policing work and prosecutorial cases need to match the global nature of the trade, or else it will remain easy for arms dealers to get off the hook. Nationally, greater transparency and accountability could make a huge difference, especially around the use of middlemen and offsets. Simply by making it compulsory to reveal any middlemen or agents who are being used, what they are being paid and what they are doing in return for that payment would make a profound difference to the way in which the arms trade is conducted globally. And I would suggest that given the closeness of the trade to government and its intelligence agencies, no contributions should be allowed by national or international law to political parties or individual politicians from companies involved in defense contracting. And there should be more graded and serious penalties for violations. The International Arms Trade Treaty that is currently being negotiated at the UN is an opportunity to do a lot of this. And given that we tend to regulate quite strictly those industries that are seen as problematic for our health or well-being, be it tobacco, alcohol, drugs. Surely an industry that counts its profits in tens of billions and its costs in human lives should be far more highly regulated than any other industry on this planet. Because if it is not, it means we accept the status quo. If we have a weak arms trade treaty, which does nothing more than provide a stamp of approval to the existing status quo, we are then accepting for all time that we're okay with the fact that using our money as taxpayers and in our names as citizens, the arms trade will continue to make the world a poorer place, a more corrupt place, a less democratic place, and ironically, a more dangerous place. Thank you very much.